Welcome back to the analysis and the data science seminar. Today, sometimes the seminar have general audience talks where just giving the audience a overview or a survey or something that is probably indirectly related to mathematics. But today here, we're happy to have Zatz Chaikin from retiree from the CS department. He's going to tell us something about Michael Levin's perspective of biology with mathematics.
Okay, thank you. That's a very apt categorization of what my talk will be about. So Michael Levin is a professor of biology at Tufts University. He directs two labs there and has affiliations with Harvard and a biotech company. Roughly 10 years ago in the lab, he discovered that patterns in embryo development appear earliest. The first time these patterns can be observed in the lab is in bioelectric fields. How do those specific patterns come from? And how do the local field values choose or cause the particular gene activation networks to get activated to make the cells differentiate? These are still very, very wide open mysteries in biology. The lab's interdisciplinary scope is well illustrated. You can see that if you go to the lab website, and you'll find, among other things, mind maps that really display their interdisciplinary approach. More recently, and you could find that stuff in on his personal broader complement blog, he started a worldwide discussion ranging over many intellectuals, philosophers, etc., of his speculation about how biology is like math in a fundamental way. You'll find it on the blog. So to give a quick summary of what I'm going to talk about is that the idea is that it's not enough to say that things work or calculate when you simulate them or in nature the way they do, just because that's what happens. That's what happens when you put together the parts, because the parts obey certain fundamental laws of physics and mathematics. Instead, what he says, even the most complex forms or patterns, they already exist in some sense. And they exist in a space whose structure we can study scientifically. And that's what he calls latent Platonic space. I'll survey these ideas and say roughly what I make of them from my knowledge of math. Unfortunately, I don't have any new results to convey to you. Almost everything you'll hear and see should be attributed to Levin's work, talks and papers and writings and collaborates. I'll only explicitly cite stuff from other people and the details of a couple of Levin's papers that I will show you. Right now, these slides are on my website, and everything's hypertext to the references. So, since Levin makes a big deal about structure, about spaces, he calls them spaces, let's talk about what we as mathematicians think of as spaces. Okay, it's very familiar stuff. A space is an object composed of elements or points, but more importantly, there's a structure. It's accompanied by a structure whose type tells us what kind of space it is. So we have to be careful and to define the structure when we talk about spaces. For example, a topological space comes with a structure of open sets. The definition of that structure, of course, includes the well-known axioms. Likewise, an ODE, also, which is the same thing as a vector field over Euclidean space, with different views of the same thing, one more geometrical, it has a structure. We might define structures like vector that we could go further and make it more applicable spaces like vector fields on manifolds. Now, let's also consider, if you don't mind, a trained neural network with all of the stuff in it, architecture, weights, etc., to be a mathematical structure. Okay, one of that network N's properties is the probability distribution that characterizes what the thing does. Okay, so for us now, so mathematics, we like categories. A category is more than just a classification. It's just so helpful, we found, to understand spaces, you know, in terms of the morphisms, the structures which are structure-specific and compatible with the space's structure and other relationships among instances. And then we have to use rigor appropriately. We have to watch out, may get really confused if you think that a category is a space of spaces. So we don't talk that way. Okay, so from one of Levin's papers, there's this picture that portrays what he means by the connection between Platonic space. So he proposes, the big proposal is that forms or patterns of even artificial living things that have never before seen elsewhere but the lab pre-exist in this space. Physical things are, he calls, affordances or pointers to a form. So life is caused by more than physics, chemistry, and evolution. It's caused by the contents and the structure of this Platonic space. These spaces are rationally structured, so scientists can make use, can explore them, and nature did its thing, was able to do its thing by evolution because of that. Now, so critics criticize this. Once you observe stuff happening, you could explain it using fundamental laws. But Levin declares, as he would on his income tax for something he receives, benefit he receives from, let's say, investing in something, that empirical benefits. This conceptual framework is crucial for making the experiments that led to a surprising discovery. So what I'm going to do for us here is that this intriguing view of his 30-year career and other biology may lead us to preliminary mathematical questions by perhaps noticing lifelike mathematical phenomena.
So at this time, these are just his speculations, right?
Oh, yeah. This is, we'll see. This is, a lot of this is speculation, and what I'm going to try to do is give tips about how we might lift it, at least in mathematical research, we might lift it to something, you know, more mathematical than speculation. So to show you where Levin's coming from, I'm going to show you a 12-minute edit of one of Levin's talks. He mentions latent space, so I think I want to point out what that meant to Levin when he started. And so briefly, what I think he means by a latent space is the collection of unobserved regularities that underlie observations. And then what you're going to hear about is that this ordered structure of space contains not only mathematical truths, he sees it as holding mathematical truths, as mathematicians think platonically, as they claim many mathematicians do, but also the higher order patterns, very complicated things, like people are in this space. So, and I say, play Levin's movie. So this will take about 12 minutes. Let me add, he doesn't say this, but elsewhere it's said that this phenomenon was discovered in bacterial films. So back to my talk. So this idea of cognition all the way down is very well explained in a magazine article written by Levin and Daniel Dennett. This explains how biologists benefited by giving up their generation ago aversion to anything that smacks of teleology. Old-fashioned teleology is Aristotle's fourth and best final cause. The final cause answers of what is its good. Say, rain. Why does rain fall? Why does rain fall? Rains. Because it grows food for us so we can live. But there's a modern view, I think Levin talks about this as well, and other people, is that to assume they discovered it's necessary in order to understand biology to assume that living things have a goal to maintain. and they propagate themselves. This is a necessary principle that biologists now use for understanding biology. We lose that understanding if we reduce biological systems to physical machines. This book, one of Dennett's last books, unfortunately, From Bacteria to Bach and Back, it describes life in terms of this goal-seeking characteristic. Okay, so now I'm going to kind of give my take of my foray into Michael Levin's stuff. First, I want to make sure it's clear to everybody what he means by an agent. That's something with goals, and that can solve problems in multiple ways, but it also senses its environment and then reacts to its environment to achieve its goals. So, number one, I think Levin argues that scientists would be wise to consider all objects 4 billion year history of evolution to have features and characteristics of goal-seeking agents with intelligent cognitive abilities. Now, of course, when you talk about ability, there's a level of ability. Some are kind of not very smart, and others are geniuses. So Levin uses the term light cone. There's a physical light cone that every one of these things has, as well as a cognitive or care light cone of the possible things it could take as goals. So number two, since they're agents, this enables the objects to navigate, that they do their living things by navigating these spaces, taking advantage of existing space structures and properties, including free lunch. So I think Levin's approach, you know, how he had to declare this on his tax return, is that he did experiments and observed trajectory changes. But that's what every scientist does. But the point is that you set out explicitly to discover the space's structure, not just see what happens and how the trajectory control machinery works. The trajectories are not merely and mysteriously emergent. He has an aversion. He sort of criticizes the use of the word emergence because there is something to discover. So this is his picture. Here's his picture of the four examples of spaces. Birds navigating in E3 can be trained to collect cigarette butts in cities. The other spaces that life traverses are more abstract, but you know, mathematicians, we are obsessed with those other spaces, not E3. Let me point out then that the bird's navigation system is not only E3 for the bird. It takes free lunch advantage of the optics of opaque obstacles and of aerodynamics, you know, in order to fly. So the bird's space has much more structure than our mathematical E3. So I would ask, what additional structures should we look for? The points in transcriptional space are vectors of and messenger RNA concentrations. They actually form a dynamical system. So we could ask things about what the topology of that thing is. And I don't know how deeply into topology those biological sciences have gone. So Levin gives a couple examples of what he means by free lunch. The first one is a hypothetical evolutionary system where it evolves triangles, and 60 degrees is the most adaptive. And the more 60 degree angles you have in your triangle, the more healthy the triangle is. Great, good idea. So if you find one 60-degree angle, that's you're doing better. You might do better if you do even better with the second, but then you don't have to do anything more to get the third to be 60. Okay, so a better example, I think, is that voltage-gated ion channels, and they embody, they do Boolean logic. So you have all the properties of Boolean algebra that life could take advantage of. So, like the universal property of the NAND gate. So I would ask, how does biology take advantage of the mathematics of Boolean algebra? So we could say the same thing about the wide range of biological control networks and fields. They embody differential dynamical systems, which was a huge collection of math known about this. So if you want to look into this, maybe you could get into something interesting by asking, what's the mathematical nature of these affordances or interfaces? I mean, we have to be careful about what we're talking about, too, when we try to mathematize it. The difference between the space of transversals, the paths that things take, and as different from where the paths are. Okay, so my modest proposal, in boldface, of course, is to ask sharp mathematical questions. Let's try to discover something by conjecturing rigorous 20th century math models for Levin's platonic space view of some biology literature or projects that we might collaborate with, and it may lead us to having to use stuff like higher category theory, you know, things like homotopy composition. Don't strictly associative, but, you know, category theory, we could handle that by going up to a higher level category where there are two morphisms of morphisms. Okay, so when we talk about categories, I couldn't resist the temptation to take Levin's picture and scribble on it to make it a commutative diagram. And then, that's easy, but the hard part is, you know, with his examples of this thing in biology, what would the morphisms be? I don't know, make changes. And then, once you've got an idea maybe what the morphisms might be, is this actually a diagram for a functor? Does that diagram commute? Well, in the current symposium, there are a couple dozen guests who are giving lectures that you could hear videos of. Lauren Ross is one of them. She's a professor of logic and philosophy. And she poses, how do we clarify distinction between explanation and other, maybe less cool, objectives of science? And her answer is, with causal explanation, the main goal is control. We could try it with category theory. Look at what does it mean. If you suppose you have two categories, a category of affordances and the category of objects in platonic space, and a mapping. If we understand everything enough, then we might, a causal explanation means for us mathematicians, we know everything well enough to prove that this map is a functor. And then, as I said, we may have to go to higher category theory. So the rest of the talk, I'll say a few words about Levin's results, a takeaway, and some speculative ideas. So I'll just move on to that. So here's one of Levin's papers. Let's see, I'm doing for time. Let's see, about half an hour. Okay, cool, good. So in this paper. The papers I'm going to show you are only simulation papers because they're mathematical. So what they did was extend the well-known prisoner's dilemma. They extended it, you know, in the standard approach to prisoner's dilemma. You do put in some sort of a learning thing where the agents formulate strategies based on the progress of the game. Or maybe there's a fixed strategy that they study. But the point is, what they did was add a kind of reinforcement learning. They also added a kind of fitness selection. And they did this to model how cells acquire particular characteristics and how all the cells in a developing organ end up doing the same thing, cooperating. And so they did the simulation. They found lifelike results. The intermediate patterns look like those observed in nature. When the memory behind the strategy system is more than one step, then they get convergence to a single cell type. But in the course of the dynamics, you get punctuated equilibria. And then they found that smaller sized individual clumps, smaller size clumps of cells with common features, and larger sized ones emerge so that, I use the bad word, so that there's like a skin around the little cells, around little clusters around big clusters. So here are some details. They extended Prisoner's Dilemma from two players to a grid of players. Besides the choice of a player to cooperate or defect, they added two more choices, merge and split. In merge, the players of the two players join, and then in the simulator, they are replaced by one player that remains associated with the original positions. Split, a clumpy a player that is a result of merging original players at original positions. The last merge that produced this cluster is broken, and then the two pieces get the memories of what they came from. So they did this, and they coded it and all that. And what they found in the simulations is, these patterns, which we look at morphogenesis of real things, they look like, it looks like this. That's what it looks like. The different colors represent the different sizes. They portray the different sizes of the players that came as a result of merging the original grid players. So they color it according to the number of things that have been merged together, and they found that the memory is bigger than one. It converges to everybody does the same thing. Now then this is the surprising lifelike pattern that there. This is a heat map. These are the big clusters. Tend to be neighbors to medium-sized clusters. So the medium-sized clusters form a skin around the big ones, you know, like we have inside our bodies. Okay, so the summary of what they did was they found that simply you have to program cooperative common behavior. Just program them to cooperate. Common cooperative behavior, cooperation, occurs when you do this biologically motivated extension of game theory, where you could get agents to share their values. And that merely rewarding long-term cooperation with limited memory-based strategies, and they added a fitness selection feature, the simulation showed lifelike patterns without, like the skin forming, without actually rewarding or programming that phenomenon. Okay, another paper, they fiddled around with bubble sort. They taken parallelized sorting where a couple of keys in two locations in an array, the keys get swapped if they're out of order, according to the lengthy order of the array. And sometimes some of the experiments, they made some of the keys not play properly, and then they had multiple variants of the key code. They found that the the patterns that formed were characteristic of life. So what they suggest in their conclusion is to seek phenomena from behavioral and information and biological sciences in the simplest systems you could find them. Now, coming from being a fan of discrete math, you know, people have made pictures of these things. Many different, there's a whole literature, many different topics in math. You have the same kind of pictures. So, for example, James Propp and some collaborators has some amazing results about Aztec diamond, about what happens, you investigate the statistics of tiling the Aztec diamond shape with 2x1 rectangular tiles. To read their theorem, it's called the Arctic Circle Theorem, for all sufficiently large n, the order of the thing, all but a tiny fraction of the domino tilings will have a tempered zone. This is a circular region whose boundary stays uniformly within epsilon, within the tiny fraction of the whole order. So what's going on here? Well, is not just two ways of placing a single tile. There are actually four, horizontal and vertical. But for, say, horizontal placements, where it sits parity-wise makes a difference. And so what's going on is that along these straight boundaries, there's a spot where once you get a downward tile on the left side, all the tiles below it on the left side must be downward. And then when you get a right-going tile on the left side, all the tiles above it have to be horizontal. And so there are four different kinds of tiles. And then what they find is basically they did was some intricate combinatorial probability analysis, and they proved this arc. So this circular thing emerges. I shouldn't say that, but I did. So this was used, actually, amazing result. It enabled them to prove the counting the number of alternating sign matrices. A hard, in the 90s, a very challenging problem. So more recently, these people, what they did was, so generating these tilings is a thing they could do randomly. And they investigated, so they used, random computer codes that build it up randomly, and they have this so-called shuffling. It's called shuffling. It's a process that they prove generates the tilings by making random choices. The resulting probability distribution for getting a tiling is uniform over the tilings. So it's probabilistic. They make little choices when they can, and then some other settings are forced by the choices. When they make the probabilities vary, not uniform over the field, they get shapes, interesting shapes. This is kind of biological. So these people did that. And then if you use periodic, so that the weights regulate when you make a random choice, which choice you should make is not, varies between, away from half, one half, which they did in the first talk, you get these, lungs. It looks like a pair of lungs. Crazy. Why do you have to have platonic space for all this? I don't know. One could be pessimistic. It's just interesting. So the takeaway, especially after bringing myself to look into Jim Propp's work, I had a great time at a birthday conference in honor of his birthday at MIT last summer. He is one of the players in a new field, newly named field called dynamical algebraic combinatorics. Dynamics, so we look at systems, these discrete systems, but not just counting how many instances there are of a given discrete structure, but take this thing where they have an instance and then some rules that to transform it to another instance of the same type and see the dynamics of applying these rules as a step. So takeaway is that really appears that local similar, same kind of interaction over the whole domain between elements in a planar lattice actually result in interesting dynamical patterns generally. That happens all over the place. The hard forward problem, is predicting the pattern's properties without simulating them. You start with a pattern, see where it goes, and who knows, because you could predict where it goes, could say something about the forward problem. That's pretty hard. An even harder problem is the backward problem, that if you look at a kind of pattern in biology, How can you set the parameters so that it develops into that pattern? That's 11 talks about this backward problems being very hard. But, you know, tilings of various shapes, like tiling the statistics of tiling the rectangle, basically uniform. They're all any tiling of the rectangle comes with equal probability. But when you constrain it to the Aztec diamond, you get the Arctic Circle. It comes to there also random choices of matchings in a grid graph is equivalent to that. So that's from math. But if we look at biology, including if we theorize about agents and goals, that may lead us to new interesting examples. New interesting things to explore, both the rules for the interactions and the patterns that we might see. Hey, this looks biological. And so why is this? Why do I think this is interesting? Why? Because evolution made use of the Platonic space subsets that make us possible. It didn't make use of the Platonic subsets that a lot of mathematics is about. The relevant subsets of mathematical Platonic space that are relevant to life science, but made us all possible. So and I wouldn't be here if it weren't for evolution doing this its thing. So it's not at all obvious how. So it's a good bet that if you could explore some of this biology stuff, pick examples that are tractable for mathematical analysis of simulation, we might have some interesting mathematics. So among the things you want to look for, tolerance to perturbation, the thing about mechanical, the thing that the deterministic systems, why biology doesn't do them, is that there's a lot of error. And evolution doesn't like it when, bang, there's a single point error. Like in your computer program, single point error, and you're dead. Blue string of death. Death, that's no good in biology. So there's tolerance to errors. There's programmability. You know, the long-winded way genes thing do their things. And mix of randomness and predictables. Think of real examples of fingers. You know, finger has a pretty common structure, but everybody's fingerprint is determined randomly. So here are some of my speculative ideas. And wow, it's 5-10 minutes to go. So I guess the properties of goals, things having goals or purposes, you know, might force that any solution to a problem that is posed in terms of some case of what used to be called teleology, goals and purposes, maybe what forces, maybe it forces them to have a certain structure. So for example, language. I heard severe criticism of what Chomsky did by Jeffrey Hinton, but Chomsky made his name by identifying common structures for all human languages. Maybe the languages have to have a structure like that, because that's the only way a language can solve, that the only way we can have a language that solves the problem of communication and cohesion and all the stuff. Teaching cultures maintained because we can talk to each other and teach each other stuff. Maybe that can only happen if language has the structure, the kinds of structures that Chomsky discovered for us. Now, second example is in machine learning. There's a recent video lecture that Jeffrey Hinton gave. He recounted in a very clear way. I really recommend you click on this link and look at it. The feature-based learning systems, the new machine learning AI versus the reasoning-based old-fashioned AI, well, the jury's out. feature-based systems are far more effective for artificially producing intelligence artificially than reasoning systems. So could it be that the problem solved by certain kinds of intelligence, like the map of intelligence, that cognition all the way down of levels of these levels of things, each one of which has its own level of intelligence measured by its cognitive and physical icons, all that stuff, that certain kinds require that every solution to make that kind of intelligence requires multi-level feature recognition and learning structure that's characteristic of today's neural networks. Okay, so sort of questions raised from a background in computer science complexity theory that I was took courses in graduate school. Some behaviors impossible in simpler systems. You know, Levin asks for try to find the simplest systems that have this sort of goal-oriented lifelike behavior. And there's kinds of questions that have been asked about what can computers do. It's called complexity theory. But today's problems are different. So for a couple of examples I have is to date, the only successful AI neural networks. We didn't see the glory and risk of AI until computers were big enough to handle the big neural networks. They couldn't do that in the 60s when neural networks were first invented. Okay, so why do they have to be so big? Now, another foray I've been into learning about proof assistance based upon Martin Luff dependent type theory, which is actually another guy's is functional programming. This has been very successful in proving hard mathematical theorems. But there's a project to formalize what graduate students learn. And I took a look at the code. It is ugly. You can't read that like a textbook, like Rotman's textbook on modern abstract algebra. No. Unless you're a real computer hacker. Meanwhile, for grad students, you give them a little at a time, and they pick it up with some of them. So, but the what's inside a human brain is certainly huge. So maybe to the kind of structures of mathematics requires a structure that is huge, even though it seems so simple because we're so, you know, as human beings are smarter than dogs. So some pointers to other things. Well, I first got into this during the pandemic. I was a fan of the Topos Institute colloquium, which you could watch online. This emphasizes category theory and things related to it as other foundations of mathematics, but they also branch out into more social things and interdisciplinary things. So they invited Michael Levin to give a talk there, and that turned me on to following him. And then right now, I talked a couple months ago to Ron, remember? Maybe we should have a discussion group who should look into this asynchronous symposium on the Platonic space. And he said, hey, why don't you give a survey for us? So that's why I'm here. Now, a good start for going further is to go to the webpage of the Platonic space symposium and listen to the first hour talk after like a 10-minute introduction. I think it's a good way of going further. And then he has an argument and a research agenda you could link from there, which I think is really cool. Then one of his talks is references this long paper, 55 pages, where you could read about this stuff in detail. And then finally, there's a blog entry about the Platonic space where he responds to questions people have asked them. Okay, so other books that I'd recommend is, first, there's this book by Rob Phillips, it's a bunch of other authors, called Physical Biology of the Cell, and it's organized, it's cell biology organized by physical principles, as opposed to a chapter on the nucleus, a chapter on the mitochondria. No, don't do that. Do physical principles, and then see what cell issues they apply to. So, in the judge's book by its cover, things that it covers are charged state, function hill, two-state system, dynamic instability, concentration gradient, potential wells, random walks, and then they have some biology stuff, coding region and giant axons. Another book is How Life Works. This is in Levin's page of favorite books, and I'll say a few words about that. Preparing for this project, I made my way through about three quarters of this book. It's a wonderful book because it's the story of the enormous change, 20 years, due to the use of biologists, used by biologists, of the data from the Genome Project. When biologists actually found out the DNA sequences, knowledge raised more questions and harder questions than it answered. They discovered that the genes don't determine in any simple way what happens. A lot more. They're now the apparent hierarchy. Life's components are hierarchical. Now, as you saw that snail-shaped figure about the interacting levels of the hierarchy in Levin's talk. The apparent hierarchy is now known to have loosely determined and highly circular and redundant interactions. Basically, the genome alone, unlike what they expected 20, 25, 30 years ago, the genome alone does not determine what creatures look like and do. Chapter on gene regulation, the first challenge is that the genes don't relate to traits in any straightforward way. The complexity is not with the genome and what genes there are, but how they're regulated. And they're regulated in really crazy ways with these lysosomes, these clumps in the DNA, and the enhancers are pieces of DNA that chemicals bind to, and the enhancer for a gene is located on the chromosome far away from the gene itself. That's a real mess. They're not described by precisely defined networks, and the levels of organization don't relate in any obvious way to those above and below. Another chapter reports what he called disordered proteins. The proteins that you could see in the images on the protein database that look like machines. They're kind of rigid, maybe like this thing, the thing that can swing. There are proteins that are floppy, and so they're we don't have a biologist here, visualize their structure at all, maybe, I don't know. But they're very important. One thing that contributes to their power is that they can adapt to all kinds of different situations that occur. Okay, and then a concluding chapter, this argues that it's necessary, disorder and redundancy is necessary. Of course, if it weren't for that, evolution would not have produced the more complex forms of life that we are examples of. To do evolution, you need the right amount of error so that things can change. But then as complexity of life forms moved to someone wouldn't. He uses progression from prokaryotic, nucleus-free cells to the ones with the nuclei, and then from unicellularity to multicell, where the cells cooperate, then to vertebrates and to matters. He discusses this in terms of the locus of causation, where it is in the biological system that the controls exist and then are and then affect things. So the locus of causation goes to higher organizational levels, of which the cognition that we have in brains, humans and other mammals, is one of the things that is a result of evolution to more and more complex things. Okay, so now I put a slide to Ball in his own words. And then, okay, so that's it. I don't know, how did I fit?
Wow,
it's an hour. Great. Okay, thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me. This is the first talk I gave in too many years to count.